Turn to the Gospel of Mark then in chapter 9, and if you were here last time as we were looking at Jesus up the Mount of Transfiguration, what a contrast, not only the contrast of a mount high up to the valley down below, but there are multiple different contrasts. Transfiguration of Jesus, as we looked at last time, is obviously a very important event in the life of Christ, as it's recorded in all three of what's known as the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And as you put all the details together, you can see more and more of the contrasts. I don't know if you noticed, but if you remember last time, there was Moses and Elijah, wasn't there, up on the Mount of Transfiguration, and they were discussing one with another about what Jesus was going to accomplish. And Moses had led the people out, hadn't he, of slavery, and he was, in a sense, the leader of God's redeeming work. They were redeemed, weren't they? They were purchased, they were bought, they were delivered, they were saved, they were brought into the promise. That was Moses' life work, wasn't it? And then what was Elijah's life? Elijah's life work was to bring these people who were in the promised land away from idolatry and paganism and a mishmash of false worship back to the true worship of the living God. And that's exactly what Jesus has come to do. He's a deliverer, a redeemer, one who brings us out of slavery. We see it again as another demon-possessed person is liberated and set free. He's been sent, hasn't he, to deliver us from all the darkness and the superstition of paganism and man-made religions, to bring us to truly worship in spirit and truth, to worship in a way that is pleasing to the living God. And so I'm sure Moses and Elijah, as they discussed these things, what agreement there would have been on the mount. Well, you come down and you're confronted with them all disputing. They can't agree upon anything, can they, really? And they're all arguing one with another about this, that, and everything else. It's almost as if up on the mount there is light and dark, down in the valley there is darkness. Up on the mount there is worship, down in the valley they are blaspheming, and the Pharisees are gloating, aren't they, saying, "We told you this Jesus was a failure and a blasphemer." Up on the mount there is power, isn't there? As Christ is seen in something of his pre-incarnate glory, but down in the valley there is weakness and helplessness. It's a picture, isn't it, in a sense, of heaven and earth. I don't go much for art myself, but there is a wonderful painting. I looked it up on the internet to look at it myself. It was the last painting of Raphael. It's up in the Vatican Gallery. And he has portrayed in a picture these two scenes, these two events. And you have Christ with his glory and the light and Moses and Elijah and Peter, James and John in a sense of absolute amazement as they are astounded by the glory, the beauty, the perfection of who Jesus is. But then the people and the other disciples down in the valley coming to realize how helpless they are without him and without faith in him, and they're all looking up with hands outstretched looking to him to receive. That's what they should have been doing, but they weren't. Jesus now with Peter, James and John, they descend, if you like, to the sad realities of earth. It's a sad reality, isn't it, that there is sickness, war, disease. What on earth could possibly persuade a man that it would be the right thing to do today to get in his car, go smash into as many people as he can with a gun and a knife? The mind boggles with it all, doesn't it, really? And life is full of sickness and disease and war and famine and death and, well, dare I say it, plain evil. There is such a thing as evil. It's not just something bad or discouraging or negative or bad life choices or perplexing things that I don't understand. No, plain evil. There is evil in the world in which we live. And we've been studying through the Gospel of Mark, and it is Jesus' job, if you like. Jesus has been sent to confront that darkness, to confront that evil, and triumph over it. You see, mankind doesn't even know that there is evil. So he looks at sickness, he looks at disease, he looks at death, he looks at all of the difficult questions of life, he looks at all of these various different things. He says, well, we've got philosophies. We've got man-made religions. We got science, we got technology, we got education, we've got money, and they list and pile all of these things up to try and deal with all of the problems that confront us as human beings. But the problem is because there is evil and because there is darkness, we don't actually know what the problem is. And so therefore it's pretty obvious that we are useless at dealing with the problem because we're actually deceived about what the problem really is. Well, Jesus wasn't at all. And Jesus' disciples weren't. And many of the people in that day and in that age, that if you'd have spoke to them in such a way, they'd say, well, of course there's evil. Move on, please. Just can you move on? You've labored over the point with nobody here doubting that there is such a thing as evil. The Jewish people had the Old Testament. They knew that the world was created and made by God, and it was created and made perfect. It was filled with righteousness, and Adam was created perfect in the image of God, and Eve as well, and it was sin, wasn't it? It was rebellion that turned everything around, that brought evil upon humanity, if you like. And they believed in a literal devil. In our day and in our age, maybe a few sitting here this morning, maybe some of the young people, maybe somebody listening over the internet, you're not convinced that there is such a thing as evil. You're not convinced of evil spirits. 100, 200 years ago, nobody would have disagreed with me, really. If you go and speak to all those that are engaged in the New Age, they wouldn't disagree with you or with me. If you go to Africa, if you go to Central and South America, if you go all over Asia, if you go to most parts of the world today who have the internet, they wouldn't doubt that there's such a thing as evil. They know that these witch doctors, they know that these spiritists, they know that those that are involved in the occult, they know that people who actually worship Satan have a certain measure of power and influence upon the world in which they live. I could pull out one illustration, one maybe a bit of an extreme illustration, but nonetheless a very true illustration. It was recorded in the Chicago Tribune from a number of years ago. A young lad by the name of Thomas Sullivan, 14-year-old boy, middle-class family, doing well at school. You wouldn't think that there'd be much evil involved in his life or around his life. This studious boy, the Chicago Tribune records, within a matter of weeks, became involved in the occult and Satan worship. He stabbed his own mother, and I hadn't planned on saying that on Mother's Day, set fire to the house, hoping to kill his father and brother, and then cut his own throat and wrists with his Boy Scout knife and died outside in the bloody snow. How do you explain that then? How do you explain a 14-year-old boy growing up in a middle-class family in middle-class suburbia just turning and changing where there doesn't seem to be any psychological explanation whatsoever? There didn't seem to be any cause for concern whatsoever. His behavior was absolutely average and normal and everything else. Suddenly gets in contact with some of the wrong boys at school or a little bit older. Suddenly gets swept into things like the Ouija board and tarot cards. Suddenly, within a matter of weeks, swept headlong into those things. So brainwashed and twisted within a matter of weeks that he kills his own mother, tries to kill his father and brother, and then kills himself outside. There is no psychological explanation for these things. Psychology, philosophy, education, and everything else that mankind wants to use can't explain those things. And I could take you to parts of Tanzania that I go to semi-regularly, and I could take you out to some of the villages, and I can show you things and take you to people that you can't explain. Things happen. Nobody, even the most middle class, even the most educated, even the most modern people of Tanzania, they look at these things that are going on around them and they say, well, that is evil. There is darkness. There are evil spirits. And you can go to the crossroads at certain times. You can go up to the highway. You can see multiple animals that have been sacrificed. You can easily find yourself a witch doctor, this, that, and the other. And they, all of them, have all kinds of lucky charms everywhere because they are afraid of evil and evil spirits. You can't explain the world around us. You can't understand the world around us, ancient or modern, without accepting the reality of evil and evil spirits. And so here it is again. You would imagine if the Son of God comes into the world to confront darkness and evil and all of the consequences of darkness, evil, sin, and ultimately to conquer the wages of sin, which is death, you would imagine that evil and darkness will come out fighting, wouldn't it? Which it does. And so it's not like we should expect to see 80 or so demon-possessed people within every 3 years, like Jesus saw it. No, this is a very, very, very special occasion in world history, isn't it? Where the Son of God has left heaven and come into earth, and darkness and evil, if you like, a personal devil with all of the other fallen spirits with him, come out to confront him headlong. So this is the source, ultimately, of all of our problems. Evolution is not a valid option for us. There just really isn't any evidence at all. And when you really scratch beneath the surface, in actual fact, it's the biggest, well, a number of people said it'd be the greatest deception of the 21st century. It's just not a valid way of looking at the world in which you and I live. So once you remove that, and you say, okay, there is a supernatural explanation for the world in which I live. The world in which I and you live is created and made by God. And therefore, we would need faith to believe those things because we can't see them or hear them with our senses. And if God reveals himself to us and he reveals that there is such a thing as evil, that's why there are all these things around you, it all just seems to fit in place, and it all just seems to make sense. If God created and made us, why is there all this rubbish around us? Why is there all this deception and lies? Why is there all this evil and darkness? Why is there the occult? Why is there murder and terrorism and all of this stuff? Well, the only explanation for us is in the Bible. That ultimately, in a nutshell, God so chose to create angels as well as human beings and created them with a choice, and we have chosen, many of the angels and mankind has chosen, to turn away from God, and now we are reaping ultimately the consequences where there is, well, just plain perverted sexual immorality all around us. Lies, deception, confusion about just about everything around us. Politically, scientifically, economically, we're in a turmoil, aren't we? There's greed and violence, sickness, pain and death, thorns, famine, earthquake, floods, pain, suffering, sickness, death, and dare I say it this morning, even hell itself. These are our problems, aren't they? And we see here in the story, don't we, that the other nine disciples are trying to confront these problems without faith. And it doesn't and it can't work. Now, many modern people today say, I don't have any faith. Yes, you do. Every last one of us has a monumentous amount of faith. Even if you say, I'm not even interested in all of those questions about whether God exists, what life is all about, where am I going when I die, all of those things, they're irrelevant. Well, by faith, you say they are irrelevant. So we all have vast amounts of faith. But what's happening here is that they're putting their faith in the wrong place. They're putting their faith in themselves, and we're going to see this morning the failure of unbelief. The disciples, through Peter, their spokesman, had confessed that Jesus was the Christ back in chapter 6. They'd been commissioned and empowered to go out and had cast out many demons previously in chapter 6. But now they're filled with self-reliance, self-dependence, and they're trusting in past achievements. They're not full of faith, dependence, and humble trust in Jesus at all. A little bit earlier on in the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter, James and John, they're just so perplexed by the whole thing, they don't know what to do, and they're just full of darkness, slowness, foolishness, and just Peter babbles a whole load of nonsense because he really just doesn't know where he is or what he's doing. He's just undone by the experience of seeing something of the glory of Christ. Now in this passage, the other disciples are full of unbelief. The Father is turning to Jesus, who we've seen 9 chapters now, who can still the storm and do goodness knows everything else in between, saying, if you can help. Well, what do you mean, if you can help? So he's got some ifs, buts, and maybes. And when he is confronted by the words of Jesus, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes, he's, yes, I believe, but help my unbelief. And as we face the multiplicity of problems and questions that human beings have, without faith in Jesus, we totally and completely fail to triumph. Like I said, science, philosophy, man-made religions, economics, environmental policies, government, and everything else are helpful in dealing with the smaller issues of life. Yes. We want good government, we want good policy, we want good environmental policies, we want good science, don't we? Of course we want good things. And they can help us with the smaller issues of life, if you like, the small branches and the leaves on the end of the tree, but it's the big things, isn't it? It's the root of the matter that we need answers for and help with. And without faith in Jesus, well, we see the failure of unbelief. You can almost hear the Father's desperate plea as he's, even with tears, and I don't know if you noticed the language there, he's not help my son or help the boy, he's help us. He's very much a part of the what is going on, isn't he? And with tears, I brought my son to you. You weren't around, so to your disciples, and they couldn't do anything. If you can help me, and then with tears he cries out. It's something of a picture of humanity, isn't it? Maybe not for us here this morning who are a bit middle class and the sun is shining and everything else, but humanity as a whole, and all of us, if you like, as we get to the end of our lives, and certainly on our deathbeds, it's a picture of us in our darkness, isn't it? That we've been conquered. That something and someone has triumphed over us and we can't escape. And even if everything goes well and we're never sick and nobody in the family is very sick and we've all got good careers and jobs and blah, 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 and everything else, we still got to confront death and the other side. And everything that we put our faith in, everything that we put our trust in, everything that we look to make us happy rather than the joy that God can give us will fail us. And you see the scribes here, the scribes, in the midst of this, there is absolutely no compassion whatsoever. And all they do is gloat and laugh and blaspheme and are glad that the disciples have failed. There is no compassion for the father or the boy whatsoever. And the disciples, they're trying to sort out their problems in their own strength. The father's at the end of himself, the state of almost total hopelessness. The crowds are powerlessly looking on with a certain morbid interest, aren't they? All they want to see is healings and miracles. And, well, John tells us that often they just followed him around because he fed 5,000 and from selfish reasons. And it's a picture of earth, isn't it? Up on the Mount of Transfiguration, there is the glory of Jesus, so glorious that even these disciples who had done multiple miracles themselves and seen Jesus do multiple miracles were so stunned and shocked by it, Peter just jabbered a whole load of nonsense because he was just undone by the whole event. It's a picture of heaven. It's unspeakable. That's why I read to the children that we rejoice with joy unspeakable. Because we have something of heaven in our lives by the goodness and the grace of God. But as you come out of heaven and down from the mount, what do you find? Yes, the sun is shining. Yes, the majority of us are middle class. Yes. Most of us are reasonably well healthy. Yes, a number of us are elderly. We've had more than our 80 years, and God has been good to us in many, many ways. There's lots to be thankful for. But also when you scratch beneath the surface, and you look outside of your own family situation maybe, you look around this town. How much drug abuse is there? How much adultery, divorce, fornication is there? It just goes on and it just spirals as you turn further and further afield and look wider and wider and wider. It's a dark, glib, evil picture, isn't it? Yes, on the surface so much looks good, but the Bible encourages us to scratch beneath it. Don't be shallow. Don't be superficial. Don't just live according to your senses and what's going on in your immediate life. Have a big view of the world in which you live. Why are you here? What are you here for? What is the world in which you live? Who is the God who made all of these things? And we'll see that without faith in Jesus, we are doomed and destined to absolute failure. As Jesus says, what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and yet loses his soul? And when Jesus confronts and when Jesus looks and when Jesus is listening now to men in their natural state, if you like, there is this deep sigh, oh, you faithless, you unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? And it's not that Jesus is harsh or unkind or impatient or intolerant or any of those things, but he is the perfect Son of God who lived by faith, walked by faith, who was absolutely filled with unimaginable faith, and he just can't believe, in a sense, the unbelief and the doubts of all those that are around him. The disciples are believing in a process, a program, a ritual in themselves and in past victories. We've done this before. We've cast out loads of demons before, and I'm sure they mentioned the name of Jesus. And I'm sure that there was something of a word of prayer as they tried to do it, but it was a half-hearted, glib nod towards heaven at best and just a passing use of the name of Jesus. And they weren't with fervency and dependency going, we can't do anything at all. Jesus, help. God in the name. It wasn't heartfelt, believing prayer as they sought to cast out this great problem that mankind has. Well, we see secondly, much more briefly this morning, the triumph of faith. Jesus' identity has been clearly revealed, hasn't it? And now Mark is asking us, how will you respond to the facts? The Father has said, if you can help us, and Jesus responds with another if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. The problem here isn't with Jesus. The problem here is with the disciples and everybody around who doesn't believe in him. faith doesn't control God, obviously, or grant all of our desires. He's not saying if you can believe, God will cease from existing, or if you believe, God will change his essential nature, or anything, or if you believe, you can get to heaven without Jesus. He's not saying things like that. If you believe in what God has said, if you believe in what God has promised, all things are possible. If you believe that Jesus died on a cross and rose again on the third day and is your only hope of everlasting life, you will receive everlasting life. If you believe, all things are possible. If you believe that Jesus is God's Son, and in receiving Jesus you are receiving God, you will know God personally in your life. If you believe that Jesus is sinless, you will receive his righteousness. God will take away your guilt and look at you as sinlessly perfect in his eyes as Jesus was. If you would believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that the Bible is the Word of God, you will have an answer to all of the big questions of life, and you can know this joy unspeakable and full of glory for yourself. If you believe that you were created by God, created ultimately for God, and you would just submit your life, commit your life, is one of the hymns that we sang this morning, just I give you my life. You will be storing up treasures in heaven for which you will be eternally rewarded. If you can believe the gospel and the scriptures and seek to live your life accordingly, you will glorify God. If you believe that God is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him, you will be rewarded. And you will know peace and joy and the love of God and these wonderful things that the gospel has on offer. If you believe what the scriptures say, and particularly what Jesus says, and seek to build your life upon it, you will be walking with God, and you will sense God walking with you. Sometimes it might feel that he's a little bit to the left or to the right, or he's gone ahead or he's gone behind, and he might be a little bit distant, but then you'll carry on walking and traveling through life, and you'll realize that there was a reason, a wise reason why he did these things, and you will know his closeness in your life at various different points. If you believe, you can know what it is to walk with God. If you believe, he says, all things are possible. If you believe, he can make you like him. Not instantly, not perfectly, but slowly, bit by bit, with all the mistakes along the way, but you learn from them, and slowly and surely, you get to a point where you'll meet somebody who you've not seen for 10, 20 years or something, or last time you met them, you weren't a Christian, and after a very short amount of time, you're so different. Your outlook on life and everything else. If you believe, you can overcome temptation. Everything that evil and darkness and the devil and everything else, if you believe, all things are possible. You can overcome, you can triumph over all of these things. You can be restored to the image of God. Now, that's what this passage is about as well, isn't it, a little bit? That where the devil reigns, he ruins, and it's tried to throw him in the water, it's tried to throw him in the fire to kill him. He's mute and he's deaf. And where the devil reigns, if you like, he seeks to ruin. As Jesus said, the thief has come to steal, to kill, and to destroy, but I've come that you may have life, and life in all of its fullness. We can know that fullness of life. We can know what it is to be transformed and changed. So that we're not under something of the devil's reign who's trying to ruin us with money or with sexual immorality or with pride or with this, that and everything else that he likes to use. But we can know what it is to have that life and life in all of its fullness in Jesus. Triumph comes to us, doesn't it? When we believe. Individually. And collectively together as a church. when we cease trusting in ourselves, when we cease trusting in past victories, when we cease trusting in programs, routines, mindless repetitions and everything else, and we go, you know what, there are so many enemies, there are so many difficulties, there are so many problems, there are so many issues that need to be dealt with, there is so much that needs to be done, which we'll talk about this evening, the only possible way we're going to know any triumph, the only possible way we're going to please you, the only possible way we're going to live according to the scriptures, if we desperately and daily cry out to you in believing prayer. And that's our third point as we close this morning, the evidence of triumphant faith. Jesus says this kind can come out but by nothing but prayer and even fasting. Like I said, I'm sure the name of Jesus was upon their lips as they attempted to cast out the demon from this boy. But they're self-confident, they're self-dependent, they're unreliant upon Jesus. And if they did pray, it was nothing more than a half-hearted, glib prayer as they took some kind of a nod to Jesus. But what we really need to do, as in Raphael's painting, is look up with empty hands to the triumphant, to the glorious Christ, to the sufficient Christ. Look up to him with our lives, committing our lives and our future and our work and our families and everything else to him, and say, help me. And that's the evidence of faith, isn't it? To really pray. Help me. I believe. Help. Now my unbelief, or as the disciples a little later on prayed, increase our faith. See, power comes through weakness, doesn't it? Because in the midst of all of this, Jesus has been predicting again and again his death and his resurrection and the consequences of what he will accomplish and achieve. And it's through death that he conquers death. It's through weakness that he brings power and the power of God's kingdom to humanity. And in the midst of all this, he's saying it's in humble, dependent, believing prayer, crying, help, Lord, that we triumph and are strong. Without faith in Jesus, we will fail. If you're an unbeliever here this morning without faith in Jesus, dare I say it, you are failing and destined to an eternal existence of failure. Without faith in Jesus, you are doomed to eternity outside of the presence of God. And all your money and all your reputation and all your cleverness and all your economics or philosophy or psychology and everything else that satisfies your heart and makes you think you don't need Jesus will be seen for what it really is. It is Christ alone that has conquered evil, the real problem, isn't it? It is the gospel alone which is good news, which is a free gift. And if we had to earn it, deserve it, work for it, do anything for it, then we would never, ever, could never, ever be good enough. And so God says, just have it as a free gift. And we just receive it as a free gift. It is by grace that we are saved through faith, the scriptures say. And we need to listen as the voice on the mountain. Listen to hear you. And for us who are believers here this morning, how do we respond to this? Oh, Lord, help me not to be like those nine disciples. Trusting in myself, going about my life and business in my own strength, trusting in past victories and everything else, but looking very humbly, very dependently, crying out, help me, Lord. Help me today to honor you. Help me today to meet with you. Help me today to prepare myself for another week. Help me this week to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Help us in our youth groups. Help us in our evangelism. Help, Lord, help. We're doing reasonably well, but we can't trust in last week. We can't trust in past victories. We can't trust in our statement of faith. We can't trust in anything but to daily, dependently pray in such a way, and we will triumph by faith. And so for believers here this morning, We've got to remember, we've got to walk by faith. We've got to live by faith. It's so easy, isn't it? To like the disciples, done this before, easy. Yeah, done this 100 times. Let's hit the autopilot. Let's just drift. We can coast. We can get this done. Hit the autopilot. Easiest thing in the world for believers to do. Easiest thing in the world for me to do that. But the passage reminds us that we need to keep coming back, don't we? Can't do this, Lord. I can't be who you want me to be. I can't do what you want me to do. I can't honor you. I can't please you. I can't serve you. I can't bear fruit. I can't store up treasures in heaven. I can't fellowship with you. I can't do any of these wonderful things that you've given to us to be and to have and to do unless I humbly depend upon you day by day. Well, may the Lord help us with these things this morning. Amen.